From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The 2020 presidential race is about more than just a referendum on Donald Trump's presidency. It is a moment when America decides whether to choose authoritarianism and fascism or not. It turns out a significant number of Americans bend toward authoritarian attitudes, whether we know it or not. Now, digging through American history, author Matthew McWilliams traces the historic framework by which we can understand the state of the nation under Donald Trump. Matthew teaches in the Department of Political Science at UMass Amherst. He served as senior research advisor to the Gallup Worldwide Survey on Authoritarianism. He's analyzed the rise of authoritarianism in Europe for the Open Society Initiative, and his writings on the issue, as well as on Donald Trump, have appeared in Politico, Vox, and the London School of Economics blog. He now joins me to discuss his new book on fascism, 12 Lessons from American History. Welcome to the program, Matthew.
Oh, thank you so very much. Very happy to be here and have a chat with you about this.
So when we have our history books looking back at the origins of this nation, they're often cast in terms of this gauzy, rosy picture of the origins of American democracy, the ideological battles that the founding fathers had about who counts and who doesn't, what equality means, and how to write the Constitution. Where does your history book differ from that sort of traditional history?
Well, my book is really trying to give context to what we're experiencing today, which I think many people are shocked by. And that's this rise of authoritarianism in our government and the response within the people. And what I did in the book is go back in time and look and see, is this new or is this something that we've seen throughout American history? And as you'd expect, we've seen aspects of this throughout American history. And you can go all the way back to the founding fathers, James Madison, and Federalist 63. And the Federalist Papers were written to support ratification of the Constitution. And Madison in Federalist 63, and I read this when I was in college a long time ago, and it really stuck with me, but he warned of something called the infection of the violent passions stirred by self-interested men. And the violent passions are, that's the activation of authoritarianism. And self-interested men, those are demagogues. So it's been with us since the very beginning, but it's the dirty laundry really in the bottom of our historical hamper in America that we like to keep way, way down. We don't want to recognize it.
We like to think that there have been built in, aspects, there have been sort of protections built into our system of government to prevent the rise of people like Trump. And then, of course, along came Trump. And it seemed as though so many of these things that we expected would have stopped Trump from abusing the Constitution or abusing the system of government were based more on tradition and norm. So a lot of the fail safes that we, I think, assumed were in place weren't real fail safes. So let's go back to how there is actually a direct line from American history to Trump. We might think that there's never been a president or a leader like Trump, but who is Trump's analog in the way back past in terms of leaders that espoused this kind of authoritarianism we're seeing today?
Well, and can I take the first part of that question or that statement? Because I think this notion of the guardrails of democracy, so many of them are norms, or they are protections in the Constitution that have been eroded by time. And two of the things that have been eroded by time, one is the, and this is also in Federalist 63, the great expanse and scope of the America, that the 13 colonies was seen as a hedge against demagogues, because it's hard to organize across that in 1800s. But obviously, the digital world well, starting with radio, analog world in the 1920s, now the digital world, got rid of that barrier. And Trump has a direct way to reach and contact supporters with fantasies or, you know, whatever he's selling. And so does anyone online. And also hate is monetized online.
He's even said that he might not be president if it weren't for Twitter.
Exactly. That was a Leslie Stahl interview that happened last week. He said without Twitter, he wouldn't have it. And the second thing that was important was the Senate to serve as a break on demagogues. And obviously the Senate, that's the oath of office is to the Constitution, and the Senate has abrogated that. But if you look through, sort of back to history to your second part of your question, I think there are two analogs, and one will, I think, surprise you. And the first is Andrew Jackson. And it's ironic that in the Oval Office, Trump had the portrait of Andrew Jackson put up in the Oval Office. But and you can just look at what he did to Native Americans in the 1830 Act, Indian Removal Act, and then the new treaties that ensued, including the Treaty of New Echota, which I write about in the book. That's where the Cherokees were. The Cherokees actually didn't sign the treaty. It was a manufactured treaty, and then they were moved to Indian country, which was Oklahoma at that time, on what was called the Trail of Tears. Thousands died. So Andrew Jackson's one. The one you're going to find surprising is Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson, you know, before and after presidency stretched over World War I, but some of the things that were done in that administration, from the Alien and Sedition Act, the encouragement and actually the fostering of a vigilante corps called the American Protective League, over 350,000 people who were supposed to check up on other Americans. This was fostered and approved by the Department of Justice. The setting up of a institution of a bureau of disinformation or propaganda. And you'll see at that point also lynching was still going on, but increased under Wilson's when Wilson was in office. You know, Wilson had the administration there. There's one book, a wonderful book I read called The Reign of Terror. And it really was a time when First Amendment rights were just thrown out. And we were really at a brink of a very bad turn in American history. And it sort of culminated at the end of his administration with a attorney general that I write about named A. Mitchell Palmer, who was a Quaker, a pacifist, and also worked on women's rights, worked on child labor laws, very progressive, but he decided he wanted to run for president, and he became a law and order candidate and ran with J. Edgar Hoover, the young, I think he was 24 years old at this time, a thing called the Palmer Raids, where immigrants, just because of the way they spoke, were.
And I've heard of the Palmer Raids, but not realized that they were linked to a person who had that background.
Yeah, A. Mitchell Palmer. The thing that's fascinating about, you know, he ran as a law and order presidential candidate and lost because he had predicted in May 1st, 2020, 1920, there was going to be this gigantic outpouring of communist and labor strikes across the country. In New York City alone, there were 11,000 police and American Protective League vigilantes on the street. Nothing happened. And the New York Post said, Mayday happened, but nothing occurred. And that was kind of the end of A. Mitchell Palmer's campaign. So those two, Jackson and Wilson, are really part of the throughput towards Trump. And then, of course, McCarthy.
Hmm. Wasn't president, but who changed the American political landscape in a way that still resonates today.
Yes, and what was fascinating, McCarthy focused on the enemy within, what he called the enemy within. and went around naming people as enemies and then calling them up in front of the Senate committee that he ended up running to interrogate them. And the leaders of the Senate at that time, the equivalent of Mitch McConnell today, allowed him to do it because it was good politics for them. And it worked in their favor and let him go. And then finally, in 1950, after a few years of McCarthyism, a senator from Maine, woman, Margaret Chase Smith, stood up on the floor of the Senate. And you can't address the senator directly, that would be against Senate rules, but talked about McCarthyism indirectly in what's known as the Declaration of Conscience. And, you know, what she had to say, it's really well worth everyone reading. I have one quote, I have trouble remembering this quote, but at the end of it, I have it over here. She said, "It's high time that we stop thinking politically as Republicans and Democrats about elections and started thinking patriotically about national security. It's high time we all stop being tools and victims of totalitarian techniques that continue here in check will surely end what we have come to cherish as the American way of life." She said that in 1950. It took another 4 years for McCarthy to be taken down. But she stood up in the Senate, had a few senators with her who supported her, and she took him on head on. So it can be done, but you've got to have people stand up and do it.
What about Nixon? He's the one that most political scientists cite when comparing a president to to Trump, who violated norms, who tried to use his office for personal gain.
Yes, Nixon certainly violated a lot of norms, but not at the end. You could draw a line from Nixon to Trump, and I think that's a good parallel to look at also. But I would say he was more just simply used racial politics almost exclusively and less authoritarian. Mm-hmm. It was the whole Nixon Southern strategy, which was to get those disaffected Democrats, Southern Democrats, to vote for Nixon, and actually built a Republican stronghold in the South with that Southern strategy. And it was a reaction to the civil rights movement, Nixon's law and order. We've seen Trump try to play the same card in this election. It hasn't worked all that well for him.
Right. He is losing the support of white voters in this second election. So we're talking about leaders in American history. Let's talk about people, ordinary people. On your website, you have an authoritarian scale, like a sort of quiz that you put out there. And I have to confess, I took this quiz and I scored, unfortunately, 25% because I thought respect for elders was very important. So tell me about this authoritarian scale. And how people can sort of use it to measure, or how we can measure the openness of American society to ideas around fascism and authoritarianism.
Yeah, and a 0.25 is very close to almost a complete non-authoritarian.
Oh, shoot. Thank goodness.
And I got to tell you, Sonali, I am a 0.75.
Okay.
And I'm very progressive. So the first thing we should know about the scale is that it's not deterministic. It means, if you score one on the scale, it doesn't mean, you're an authoritarian law and order, authority, order, uniformity person. It means you're more likely to be that. It's probabilistic. So it's a probability score more than a deterministic score. And it's based on the questionnaire that you saw on the website is based on four questions. They're child rearing questions, so they have nothing to do with political behavior or political attitudes or political preferences. They come out of the beginning of it was 1931, the Frankfurt School in Germany, which started trying to understand the rise of an authoritarian party, which turned into a fascist party, the Nazis. And then we're brought over here to this country, the beginnings of these questions, by the, once the Nazis got in control, the Frankfurt School had to leave because they're all Jewish intellectuals. Eric Frome captured the notion of it in his really seminal book in political psychology called Escape from Freedom, saying that authoritarians, what they want to do, they seek security, so they try to escape from freedom. So these four questions were perfected over time, and really in American political psychology, science, and polling were used, started about 1992. And what we have found, I'm just part of this tradition. I'm not the leader of this tradition in any way, shape, or form. But what we found has been very consistent since 92 through my surveys 2016. And I have one coming out of the field. I think it's the end of this week. And that is about 18%. So, give or take a percentage in there of Americans are highly disposed to authoritarianism, which means they score one on the scale. And there are about another 23% who are one, that's my level, one step down, 0.75 on the scale. And what this is a reservoir of people who can be activated by fear. It doesn't mean they're authoritarian all the time or else we'd see a different government, but they can be activated by fear. And that's what Madison was talking about in Federalist 63.
So what about broader scale surveys that and how do we know what Americans, where they stand on these issues today? Is there information? You open your book, in fact, talking about some results from the Index of American Authoritarian Attitudes. So tell me about that. Let's get a sense of where Americans are.
Yeah, and so here's the thing that's interesting. So you take this authoritarian scale, and I have one other question. It's just been added in the last 2 years, but let's not go to it. It's down in the weeds. You take this authoritarian scale, and you ask policy questions, preference questions, and what you find is authoritarians are much more likely to answer in a way that we would consider to be an authoritarian answer. So a big one is the first one on the authoritarian scale, on the authoritarian index, is support for democracy. And 46% of Americans do not have a strong support for democracy.
46%. I mean, how is the question 46. Asked? Do you support democracy? And 46% say no?
No, it's five questions.
I see.
And if you fall out on one of them, you are not considered a strong supporter of democracy. And here's the question that people fall out on, and you can see the linkage to authoritarianism. And the question is, let me just read it. And it comes from the World Values Survey. So it's asked around the world to scale support for democracy. And are you more likely to agree, more likely or less likely, so it's agree, disagree, that our country, so the United States, should be governed by a strong leader who doesn't have to bother with Congress or election?
Got it.
And people who agree strongly or somewhat are considered to be less supportive of democracy. There are other questions in there. Should the army rule the country? There are other things like that that go into that scale, but that's where that comes from.
Wow.
Go ahead.
Let's talk, just in the interest of time, give me a sense, if you can summarize then, when was this survey done, whose results you describe in your book, and does it help explain why Trump, as a presidential candidate in 2016, got so much traction that even though he lost the popular vote, he won enough votes in the right places to become president?
Yeah, I think it does in part. I think authoritarianism is the taproot of a lot of bad isms. Hostile sexism, racism, ethnocentrism. If Larry Bartels were here, he'd be talking about that. And groupiness and othering of people. So it's the taproot of that. And the first survey I did was right at the end of 2015. And it was in the Republican primary, of Republican primary voters. And I asked authoritarianism and a whole series of other questions. And what I found is that authoritarians, there was one candidate that Republican authoritarians supported more than anyone else statistically, and that was Donald Trump. Hmm. And from that, I wrote an article in Politico in early 2016 saying, this is a real movement. It is galvanized, catalyzed, and he can ride it all the way to the presidency. Wow. And since he became president, he has just been building on that. Levitsky and How Democracies Die, which is a great book, talks about the electoral revolution of authoritarianism. So using the electoral process to install an authoritarian government, and that's what we have. He got in office. He has undermined guardrails, as you've talked about. He's divided, put us versus them. He's othered people. And, now he's, things like what was 1776 commission that he mentioned, I think it was an executive order on it, to really sanitize and whitewash history. He doesn't want the history that I've written, that many other people have written, to be seen. He wants a whitewash version, the diversity executive order, the civil service executive order, which to me is one of the scariest one,
right.
Which is gives him the power to fire professional civil service people who don't agree with him politically. And he's already done that. The head of NOAA was fired by what can only be described as a political commissar.
So putting in political appointees in the place of civil servants who are supposed to serve across administrations in nonpartisan ways. So finally, one of the people whose work you cite in your book is the historian Richard Hofstadter, and he has been known to write about the paranoid style in American politics. So through the lens of Hofstadter's work, what should we know about American culture in order to really try to work on ourselves going forward, regardless of what happens on November 3rd?
Yeah, and that's a great question. It really is. It's my second chapter, is the paranoid style, because Richard Hofstadter hit the nail right on the head. He saw this through line of paranoid politics, fear-driven politics used to do extremely un-American things to Americans and people in our country. And I think what we have to learn from this is that we have some real challenges. If Trump wins, there is the hollowing out of democracy will continue unabated. And we will start to look like Hungary under Viktor Orban right now. If Trump loses, we have a lot of work to do, because there is an act, authoritarian Americans have been activated. And some of them are our neighbors. Some of them might be our crazy
uncle. Or family members.
Or our family, a crazy uncle. And we have to get to a point where we can engage and talk civilly and non-ideologically about common issues and problems that we have. But we need the same set of facts, and we don't have those now. They're really at least two fact universes. And we have a real problem with digital communications. We have freedom of speech, absolutely 100% freedom of speech, but the digital world favors and monetizes and rewards hate and conspiracy and fear. And that's very, very dangerous, because fear is used to divide us, not to bring us together. There's sort of three things we have to do politically or personally. We got to stop othering each other. And it's hard. It's really hard. But we have to do that. We have to talk. Socially, institutionally, we have to rebuild the guardrails and of democracy, because they've just been blown away. We can't allow the president to use the Department of Justice to as his personal lawyer. To lock people up, or even talk about locking up political opponents. We're not a banana republic. And then three, socially, we have to confront our history. We can't whitewash it anymore. Now, there's a through line from slavery, 1619, to George Floyd. And systemic racism has to be directly addressed. Chinese exclusion, you know, there's a reason Trump calls it the China virus. And that comes right out of the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. We need to address these things maturely as a democracy, because that's the only way democracy will survive. You know, democracy is really fragile. And we've seen how fragile it is, and go to Europe and see how fragile it is right now. And we have to do a lot of hard work to really fulfill the promise of this country, which is aspiring to great things, but it's up to our generation to do it.
Well, Matthew, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Let's see what happens in the next week.
Please stay safe out there and keep doing the great work that you're doing.
Thank you so much.
I really
you too.
Appreciate it. Thanks. All right. Have a good one.
You too. My guest has been Matthew McWilliams. He teaches in the Department of Political Science at UMass Amherst. And he has written about American authoritarianism and Donald Trump in outlets like Politico, Vox, and the London School of Economics blog. We've been discussing his latest book, simply called On Fascism, 12 Lessons from American History. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify. Bye.